Tonight we won't be bringing you our advertised show of Raylene Boyle, and however, we will be bringing you Don Chip a bit later on, because today's one of those peculiar days where things spin out of control. You would have probably heard the news by now that Steve Irwin, the crocodile hunter, died today in tragic circumstances. Scuba diving, a stingray's barb went into his heart. Steve was only 44, and obviously our thoughts go out to his wife Terry and kids Bindi and Bob. And so what we thought we'd do tonight is two tributes to two extraordinary Australians. Later on, Don Chip, but first, the larger-than-life Steve Irwin, who visited us in 2003 and gave us one of the most watched episodes of Enough Rope ever. Here is The Crocodile Hunter. Steve Irwin, I'm looking forward to this. This is going to be a lot of fun.
It will be. Come on fire, mate. So let's get into it.
We're already at the red level for energy, and we haven't even got to the first question. The Australia Zoo, which is now Steve Irwin Central up there on the Sunshine Coast.
Yeah, mate, that's where my heart beats from.
Now, this was started by your mum and dad back in the 70s, and it was hard, wasn't it? It was so hard sometimes your mum would cry. What was so tough?
Well, mate, it was 1970, and Dad was a plumber, really well-to-do plumber. He did really well in Melbourne, but he gave it all away to follow his passion, which was reptiles. And Mum was a maternity nurse who actually wanted to follow her passion, which was joey kangaroos and koalas and wombats and platypus, raising them. You know, they're getting hit by cars all the time. So together they started the Biwa Reptile Park in 1970. And it was tough times. We're on the main highway, like the Bruce Highway, but it was the Biwa Reptile Park. And at that stage, you know, snakes were something you hit with a stick.
Yeah.
You know, crocodiles were just evil, ugly monsters that kill people.
Yeah.
And koalas and kangaroos made, you know, great fur coats.
Yeah.
So it was hard times,
and
mate.
Not a bad barbecue either.
Oh! Lucky enough, we're putting our foot on that kind of attitude,
that was wrong. People.
And it was, you know, tourism. Exactly. Yeah. And I'm bigger than you, mate.
Yeah.
Hey, tourism.
This could be a bad interview if you actually wrestle me to the ground and tie.
Should we do that?
Tell you what. Let's get a bit further in and then we'll see how we go, all right?
Yeah.
Because if we're going to do it, I want to oil up first. No, never mind.
But seriously, tourism was, you know, it was in its infancy back then, and it was so tough that Dad had to go fishing on the sideline. He had to grow strawberries and capsicums to actually support his passion, which was this wildlife facility.
Yeah. You grew up with the animals. They were your playmates, weren't they?
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. Andrew. You know, like, in my house when I was growing up, Mum would have 12 pouches, you know, make-believe kangaroo pouches set up on the backs of chairs, just virtually everywhere. So we'd have 12 little joeys ranging from little pinkies all the way up to one-year-olds. You know, koalas hanging off the curtains, you know, with gum leaves stuck in there. Sugar gliders gliding through, like you'd be walking down through the house. Stay with me, mate. Where is he? You're walking down through the house, the next minute, clack, you know, on your bare back, you'd be a possum, ripping to you. And of course, inside the house was just Snakesville.
Really?
Oh, crikey, mate. Chock-a-block full of snakes. Like every wall that was spare had snakes in it. You know, starting a reptile park, which then became a fauna sanctuary back, and then it was like, whatever you could jam in the house, mate, because everything needed to be close to your heart.
Your dad actually reckons you've got a gift.
Yeah.
An animal instinct, which enables you to deal with animals. What is that gift, do you think?
Yeah, well, Dad was kind of the first one to notice it, and good on him. You know, I'm just a product of my parents and my environment. And I was 4 years old and Dad was catching snakes for the then Commonwealth Serum Laboratory, right? And he was looking for brown snakes and tiger snakes at a place called Buller in Victoria. And so we're looking for tiger snakes and brown snakes. And I'm 4 years old and I'm rattling around helping him. But, you know, I was playing imaginary games, imaginary armies, you know, shooting back at the... it was Japanese back then because my grandfather and great-grandfather died in World War II. So it was the Japanese I was hunting. Whatever, please don't. You know, like, I drive a Toyota.
Yeah.
So, nonetheless, hunting around, and Dad's over there, and here's this huge brown snake, oh, absolute whopper, well over 5 foot, so I've come up on it, I've gone, got it. Dad, I got one. And he's like, what is he on about? And he comes up, look at this, Dad, and here's this brown snake, Andy, and it's up on my shin, like I'm wearing plastic sandals, no socks either. And here's this brown snake with its head right on my leg, and I've got a pin, and it's a whopper, it's almost as thick as my dad's wrist, and he's gone whack, you know, and belted me out of the way, crushed me like a bug, because I thought I'd got this brown snake for him, and I thought I was going to come out of this a hero, and he decks me. But he thought he'd saved my life, and, you know, for months he's scratching his head, how come that kid never got killed by that brown snake? And I guess he figured it out then, he's figured, this kid's got something. So, you know, he's watched this develop. Then Mum and Dad just propped me up. Every time I'd make mistakes, they just keep, you know, hang in there, lad. And they just kept helping me and persuading me to follow my passion, which was wildlife. And that, in essence, you know, helped me to be who I am.
I'm fascinated with this idea of this gift. Do you have a sense of it? When you're dealing with an animal, do you have a sense of, I know what you're going to do, can you pick its personality, for instance? What is it in your head?
How on earth could I explain that? You know, I'm in Africa, right? And here's a pride of lions. I've never worked with lions in my life, ever. Righto, got a camera crew with me. I'm like, oh, yeah, there's a pride of lions. Oh, I'm going to crawl up to them. You know, like last week, a Japanese tourist got killed and eaten by a lion. Probably the same pride that did it.
Yeah.
But for some known, unknown thing that goes in my head and my heart, I kind of know what I can do. So I get on my, you know, all fours and I go up to these lions and sneak right up to them. And Johnny Staten, who's around here somewhere, he's filming it and he's like this. What's he doing? And I get up to the lions and stand up and go, hey. And they go, wah! And run off. How do you explain that? I don't know how to explain that. And I've never been bitten by a venomous snake. I play with them every day. And I've not, well, kind of play with them, and never ever been bitten. And I think that's, it's because, you know, when I grab a venomous snake, it's like, you know, going in on your shoelace. It's like, you know, people tie their shoes.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't really give a rip. Whereas me, it's like, oh, you know, you're very gentle with the shoelace. You know, it's like this, mate. You get a snake, like most people deal with snakes. Now, fair dinkum, what they do is the first thing they do is they go for the head. Get them for the head, right?
Yeah.
Now, what's the sensation when someone goes for your head? It's like pretty threatening, isn't it?
Yeah.
Instantaneous, you're like, you know, you're freaking out. So the snake starts freaking. So what I do is gently coerce the snake, hence muck with more venomous snakes than anyone else in the world and never been bitten. It's a gift.
Tell the truth. Is there ever a time when you're afraid?
Yeah, plenty. Plenty of times. Unfortunately, in my line of work, I have to deal in some really heavy-duty places, you know, like East Timor, for example. You know, I was up there when there was some strife going on. I spend a fair bit of time in Central and South America, a little bit of strife going on there. Had a couple of nasty incidents happening in Africa and Kenya, not long after the Nairobi bombing, actually. Yeah, they make me scared, like, you know, pretty scared. But what scares me more than anything is bringing my daughter into the world. You know, the world has changed, Andrew, hasn't it? You know, there's this dark cloud of terrorism. And she's been on 230-odd flights, I think, and she's, like, just 5 years old. So we spent a lot of time in planes because I like to take my family wherever I go in the world. Mm. Yeah, people factor does actually scare the living daylights out of me, and I've seen some pretty awful, icky sort of things going on.
So animals don't scare you, but humans do.
Oh, fair dinkum, mate. They do. Yeah, they do.
I don't think you're alone in that. I want to talk more about family in a little bit, but I'm curious, in you off stage when you're not performing,
yeah,
is there anything in your wardrobe that's not khaki?
I got a pair of jeans.
Yeah?
I got a pair of jeans, and I'm constantly given shirts. Like, I had the world's top surfers, actually, up at the zoo. I was filming with them, and so they gave me a heap of shirts. So I've got a lot of shirts. I don't wear them, but I get given a lot of gear,
yeah,
you know, like surf wear and, you know, like the Andrew Denton Show shirt and stuff.
We're getting that to you, yes.
Yeah, but basically I got more car keys than you poke a stick at. How's this, though? What a coup. Like, this is so Australian.
Yeah.
So I do this movie, right, MGM. The big MGM,
yep.
Rightio, Mudguts McGraw, signs us up for this movie. you know, and there's a lot of dough in it, and, oh, you know, and there's this person looks after wardrobe. So they've got, they just get me, like, packets of car keys. This is some of them. See how they're really nice and shiny, you know, like, these are straight out of the packet, mate.
This is formal car key.
Absolutely. Yeah. Special show, special gig, this one. So, oh, you know, and how many will you need? So, oh, geez, big shoot, 40. No one done. Well, I'm only going to need, you know, a dozen sets because, you know, it's only easy to wash. And so I've still got, like, dozens of them left in the packets. Talk about rip off the big people, eh? It's like, it's all about what falls off the back of the truck.
And, you know, to this day, the management of MGM are going, God damn! We've been swindled out of all our car key reserves.
That's right. It's all about what fell off the back of the truck.
Are you always at this level? Is there a quiet Steve Irwin?
No. Nah, mate. No.
Seriously?
There is. I had my shoulder taken off twice.
Yeah.
Oh God, I was quiet then, mate. Yeah. And I had a few cartilage operations, so, you know, like stuck in the hospital with the drips and all that, and.
But beyond being heavily medicated, is it? Do you have moments of repose, moments of just, I'll just take it in and sit quietly?
No. You know, I have to do a lot of plane flights.
Yeah.
And, I'm a handful. I don't know, I haven't made it in the tabloids as the bloke who started the riots and stuff on the planes yet. But I guarantee you it will happen. You know, you can't hang your arm out the window, and you can't stop and have a pee and look at the wildlife. You know, you're stuck in this thing for, like, sometimes 14 hours in a leg. You know, like, going to America is just, it's a 14-hour stint, mate, and it's shocking awful to sit there. And all the, you know, you can't, I'm just, you know, I like a good movie, but not five of them in a row. It's like... And I don't read much, you know, like I'm just...
You don't read? How come you don't read?
I do read, but, not, you know, like, not for 14 hours. Yeah. You know, surf mags take a good 20 minutes. Yeah.
Do you talk to the person next to you?
No, I try not to.
Really?
Yeah, because normally it's John Staten. He's my manager, yeah.
So, yes.
Avoid talking to him at every opportunity.
Do you ever get down? You talked about being, you know, frightened by human behaviour. Yeah. What gets you down?
I've been down, mate. I've been down. I've been way down. I've been down. I've been down as far as anyone can go down, mate. I lost my mum in a car crash. I went down. I went right down. I watched my dad suffer. I watched my whole family suffer, and I have never felt pain like that in my entire life, my friend. And what it did for me was it actually hammered home the whole family value thing and what it's like to have a family and everybody's someone's mum, you know. And I was down. I was down for the count. I was down for 2 years. I was down, way down.
You
pain.
You truly adore your parents, don't you?
I love my parents just so much, mate. You know, like my mum, how'd you be? You know, I was born on her birthday and all she ever did was just love me and prop me up and get me back out in there. And my dad, just the legend of the universe. When I was the tiniest little kid, Andrew, I'd look up at my dad and, you know, he was like larger than life. He was just like this action hero. He was everything I wanted to be. And all I've done in my life is follow in his footsteps, mimic him, and try to be him. And nowadays, I just try to make him proud, mate. Yeah, I love my parents like nothing else. It's just they are everything to me, absolutely everything. And the day that my mum went was the day I lost something. I lost something. Lost something really big.
It's interesting when you say you've mimicked your parents, you look up to your dad, you've basically carried on the family business. Do you have a sense of yourself as yourself? What will it be for you when your father goes? Will you be able to be yourself?
I see my dad getting older and older and older. And I must admit I'm scared. I'm really, really scared that when I lose him that my life is going to change yet again. I am going to go down again. But I'm really lucky that I've got the most drop-dead gorgeous wife on earth who is just so strong. And so passionate and so Steve-O orientated. Like, she just... No, mate, you wouldn't... She is... She, if I said, righto, sweetheart, today, we're going to jump off a cliff, she'll go, righto. She'd pack a bag, though.
Yeah.
But she'd go, hey. Practical, like, yeah, I've got this thing. I've got the Terry factor, mate. I've got this wife that is so incredibly intelligent and strong that I reckon between us we'll get through it. And, of course, my daughter is like... She's going to be a Tibetan monk. She is, like, incredibly insightful. And when her gran died, she was very, very young, but, you know, she'd hold my hand and she'd give me strength. And to this day, you know, when I get an owie, like a croc bites me, you know, she'd put banana leaves on it and stuff and, you know, make me feel good.
Yeah.
And I guess when that time comes, because... I'm not sure what's going to happen, but I've got some good, strong people, good, strong family around me, mate.
You say that Terry's very Steve-O-oriented. If the reverse happened, if Terry said to you, unlikely though this might be, Steve, I want you to stop the travelling. I want you to just stay home. Would you be prepared to do that? Does it work both ways? She'd jump over a cliff for you?
Absolutely. I'd do anything for her. Absolutely anything. My word. I got so lucky in 1992 when she walked into the zoo... And I'm doing a crocodile demonstration. I looked in the crowd. I'd been in the bush for 2 years, mate, catching crocs. Haven't seen any sheilas. Come back. So, you know, I was hungry. And come back and I'm doing a croc demo. And I look into the crowd and I see her. And I'm like... whoop, 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 whoop. To feed the croc, you know. Bloody croc tried to kill me and that. And she stayed back and started talking to me. And that was it. Head over heels in love. And if she says to me, that's it, you know, that we're stopping, we're doing this... I'd do it because I know that she would not ask me to do that if it wasn't for the benefit of us, the family. It would have to be for the benefit of my daughter and our kid that's due to come. Otherwise, she wouldn't ask. She's not that kind of Sheila, you know. She's into what I'm into. She's as passionate about wildlife as I am. If I said, you know, go up and... stick your head in that elephant's bum, she'd do it, mate.
You're a smooth talker, Steve.
I am. Romantic.
Foreplay in the Irwin family. Yeah. You said that getting married was the scariest day of your life. Why was that?
Scariest day of my life, mate. Because
did you have a khaki tuxedo?
I had, I don't know, some penguin suit and it was black.
Yeah.
It wasn't khaki, so I'm out of my element for a start. Yes. In a tie.
Yes.
I was panicking. Yeah. Absolutely panicking. Ooh, something in your bottom.
Oh, crikey.
Crikey, it's a radio mic. Have a look at this little beauty.
So, what got you over the moment of panic?
I don't know. I made it. I just made it. I just bared with it and got there.
Yeah.
But I was panicked, mate. I was so panicked. I don't know. My wife's going to kill me when I tell you this. But I'm going to tell you, because it's this kind of show, isn't it? He just sucks it out of you, doesn't he? And I've seen that about your show. So I'm so scared, so anxious, so incredibly out of my element. You know, we get back to the hotel, the motel, you know, nice honeymoon suite and that, and I couldn't consummate the marriage, mate. I was freaked.
Really?
Yeah. I sat there and ate a steak and said... But it didn't take long after that.
I could make a terrible reference to T-bones, but I'm not going to. You actually, for your honeymoon, correct me if I'm wrong, you ended up in the mangrove swamps in far north Queensland with a four-man camera crew.
Our first two documentaries was our honeymoon with a film crew. How's that? Amazing. And that gives you an
difficult
idea.
Difficult is how it is, I would have thought.
Bloody oath, mate. Imagine, like, we're just married. So I got over the whole nerves thing, and you've got this hot-looking Sheila, and you haven't had it, you know? So nonetheless, and here's this film crew, and you want to, because it's your wife and that. And you can't. Nonetheless, I worked it out. We had a faster boat. So I'm like, yeah, just kind of, we'll meet you around the corner, you know? Yeah.
It's a 12-stroke.
The V12.
You talk about your daughter, Bindi. What's your philosophy of fatherhood?
My philosophy of fatherhood you know, I just treat her exactly the same way as I would want to be treated. And you know the funny thing is, Andy, I treat my wildlife the same. You know, like if there was a croc there, I'd treat that croc like I'd treat my daughter, like I'd treat you, like I'd treat my wife, like I'd treat anyone. I treat things how I, in turn, would want to be treated. So my little kid, I just treat her how I want to be treated. You know how my mum said, you know, you can't have ice cream for breakfast? Here, sweetheart, have it. Go hard. And you know, yeah, absolutely. You want to catch that snake? Sure, it's venomous, but we'll do it, and I'll show you how, and we'll do it, and we did it.
You have animals in the house, don't you?
She's, oh, yeah, my word.
She came up close to a carpet snake at one point.
Yeah, bit her right on the face, her first snake bite.
Oh, yeah. That must have been a proud moment.
It was a very proud moment. She's a snake maniac. My daughter's a snake freak. She loves snakes, her favourite animal, the snake, you know, born and raised with snakes. So, you know, here's this carpet python coming across the road at night. We're going out to Poppy's house. And she's like, oh, daddy, you know. I was like, yeah, don't worry, sweetheart, I'll save it. So I run out there, I grab the snake, and she starts whinging, you know, I want the snake. She's like, all right, sweetheart, here. But watch out, he's a bit bitey, and she grabs it. And she starts singing, rock-a-bye, baby. Like this, and it goes, whack, bites her right on the lip. And she's like, I see, I told you, sweetheart, told you he's going to bite you. She's like, it's okay, Dad. Rock-a-bye, whack, right on the nose. And, let it go, Dad. Gave it back to him. His blood all pouring down there, and I was very proud of it.
Is she... Because you were raised to have no fear of animals, and it seems to me you naturally didn't. Is Bindi the same? Is she going to be the same?
I reckon she's a bit smarter than I was. In fact, I'd say she's a lot smarter than I was. I think the whole... girl thing, you know, this whole girl-boy thing. I don't know what it's like to have a boy, but they don't seem all that incredibly intelligent until they reach 30. Really, I wasn't all that intelligent until I reached 30. Bindi, I see, is a lot more clever and calculated before she actually jumps in. She'll, unlike me, when I was, say, 5 years of age, she'd anticipate head, tail, body, dad's there, he'll take the head, I'll get this bit. Whereas me, I just would have jumped in there. So I think she's a little more clever and calculated than I ever was at that age.
Terry's due your second child in December.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thanks, mate. Thanks very much.
How important would it be for you to have a boy?
Well, that's what we were shooting for. And we did it all right. I mean, Terry... met the Sheila in Melbourne that's got a high success rate in, and she's got this formula that you got to get a boy. So Terry had to go on this very special diet, you know, high salt, no dairy, and Terry loves her dairy products, no dairy, and I had to have these special techniques too, which, and now that she's pregnant, thank goodness I'm over them, like no underpants, fair dick, because you've got to get airflow around your testicles, see? Well, no, seriously, though, when you look at athletes, you know, because their testicles are always hot, that they throw girl babies. Apparently the warm sperm, a girl sperm?
Or really? Something.
Yeah, and the cool ones are boy sperm. So you've got to keep your testicles, because I run pretty hot anyway. And so, yeah, plenty of airflow there.
This is getting into the realm of too much information right now.
Sorry, mate, asked me the question. No, no. So, but it, seriously, we went and, you know, the Chinese birth chart threw that in, you know?
What's that?
Oh, I don't know. Some Chinese birth chart thing that Terry was following. Right. Heaven forbid, I don't know anything about it. All I know is I had to go without underpants for a year, and I go to areas where things bite you down there. You imagine, like, you're sitting in the mangroves like this. You know, it's like... Underpants, in my line of work, seriously, good-fitting underpants are very, very important. Very important.
So clearly going for all this, having a boy was what...
It was our priority. Yeah, it was our priority. But now that she's pregnant, she's big. She's big.
Yes.
Pregnancy really, she's into it. She's... Yeah. No, she's not like the Hollywood, you know, little bump thing. She's I don't know how you say it, but she's bloody big. And, sorry, sweetheart. But we really, really wanted to have a boy, but now, you know, going through the ultrasound and all that, we've said to the obstetrician, look, you know, don't tell us. We don't want to know because it doesn't matter. You know, it's not like we can throw it back. You know, it's not like, not going to keep it. And lo and behold, Bindi wants a sister anyway. So Bindi, you know, she really, really wants a sister. The reason being, every single night of her life, even when we were up in Cape York Peninsula, just had a big day catching crocs, we sleep together, myself and my daughter, you know, always that's the last thing at night. We sit there and she wants to hear a daddy story, and it always has to be, what do you want to hear, sweetheart? I want a daddy story. Okay. I want it when you were a naughty boy. Like, I got 1,000 of those and, or more. And so I've told her all these naughty boy stories. So there's no way she wants a brother. Because my sisters also tell Bindi how I was a pretty hectic sort of a brother to have. Really heavy, really hectic.
Is that right?
It's true.
I just imagine you as this quiet, quiet kid.
Passive, mousy sort of a bloke. Nah.
What are you and Terry fight about? Because all couples fight.
Yeah, we do. Yeah. Oh, mate, we had it. The worst one we had was a bonzo. I said, what is it? You know, what are you so grumpy about? You know, what do you hate about me? She's like, oh, I can't believe you just take your shirts off and throw them in the wash. Why don't you undo your buttons like a normal person? The buttons on my shirt. I mean, who cares? Who cares? So that was the worst one we had. That was like, I couldn't believe it.
A lot of people see you as this larger-than-life Steve Irwin.
Yeah.
In some ways, a one-dimensional, almost cartoon character. But what they perhaps don't know is you've bought huge tracts of land in Australia, Vanuatu, Fiji, US. Why have you done that?
I'm a conservationist through and through, Andrew. That's why I was put on this planet. Easily the greatest threat to the wildlife globally is the destruction and annihilation of habitat. So I've gone, right, well, how do I fix that? Well, making a quid here, people are keen to give me money over there, I'll buy it. I'll buy habitat. And I reckon the only thing wrong... Now, how's this? The only thing wrong with, you know, wildlife in Australia is that I don't own it. Now, I could imagine how many kangaroos and crocodiles I could have if I owned Australia. It's, my wife is an American, so she's got this, she's a good capitalist, and she's very clever with money. Me, I'm not that clever, and I don't really give a rip, but she is, and so whenever we get enough cash and enough and a chunk of land that we're passionate about, bang, we buy it. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to set an example to the world that every single person can make a difference, particularly those in the political arena, those that have zoological facilities, any, you know, multinationals, any millionaires. They can all make a difference by buying chunks of land. And in addition to that, every single person, man, woman and child, no matter what walk of life you're in, whether you're a fisherman, a janitor, Steve Irwin the croc hunter, you can make a difference in wildlife by simply not purchasing wildlife products. Because today, Andrew, the wildlife perpetrators, they're hard to spot, mate. But what it is, these wildlife perpetrators now kill animals and call it sustainable use. That, oh, let's kill crocs, turn them into belts. That's sustainable, you know? That isn't sustainable. Since when has killing wildlife saved anything? So I'm a bit of a, you know, I'm a wildlife warrior through and through. And, you know, buying land is, you know, A, means that we're going to be able to get animals back if and or when they become highly endangered. And B is getting out into the world, taking you, the audience, with me, having an adventure and making it exciting. Otherwise, you know, you're stuck with the demographics that, say, David Attenborough's got, which is a bit smaller than what I got, and changing people's opinions on wildlife. How's this? For the first time in history, mate, I've just been involved with an issue where people were worried about the welfare of a shark. How's that? For the first time in history. Yay! Astounding. Absolutely astounding. A tiger shark. And admittedly, the tiger shark was doing great, but her name was Bonnie. She was 14 foot and, you know, I helped capture her and release her back into the wild. The first time in history, people are seeing crocodiles and snakes as animals that have welfare issues, which is fantastic. So I believe If I can secure enough habitat, then there will always be places for the animals to go when they've been annihilated throughout their habitat. Because basically, mate, the human population is going off. It's just a bit too rapid for the old Mother Earth to keep up with, mate. And so this is my way of helping her out.
You've got an extraordinary reach. I mentioned in the introduction an audience of about 200 million people.
Hey.
I don't think people in Australia have any concept of how big you are in America. You have bodyguards. You have dummy helicopter decoys.
Yeah. Just
how mad does it get for you over there?
Oh, it's chaotic. It is bizarre. I get off the plane and there's some way that they've got into the computer cyberspace and work. You know, he's coming in. And they're waiting for me there. So, you know, that's where this spearhead of police, bodyguards and stuff starts from the moment I get off the plane. And then they'll follow the limo. So the limo has to do, you know, tactical stuff. We even had to call the police in to give us a hand. I got a hold up in a hotel, you know, not game to go downstairs, you know, because radical fans down there. I think the downside of being really, really good in this... this thing we call the media, as you are, is fame. That's the downside. Correct me if I'm wrong, Andrew, but crikey, sometimes you'd just like to be Andrew Dent and go down and buy your newspaper and your milk and not have to worry about someone coming up, you know, can I have your autograph, can I have this, can I have that, you know, and worrying about what's going on.
I've never had that happen to me. Steve, but, you know, it's fine for some. It's fine for some.
Sorry, mate.
No, it's all right. It's not an issue. We'll move on. Earlier in the year, I interviewed the Wiggles and they talked about their De Niro moment, performing on stage in America and looking down and there was Robert De Niro in the audience. And they were like, I can't believe this is happening. Do you have a De Niro moment where you've just gone, can't believe I'm here, can't believe it's happening?
Plenty of times, all the time. It seems every week, every month, every day, there's another De Niro moment. It's the weirdest thing being me, mate. Like, I guess because I'm the thing that the Hollywood megastars watch, you know, I just can't believe it, you know. I can't believe I'm having these De Niro moments, you know. Like, I got invited to Bill Clinton's farewell dinner and...
Yeah?
Oh, yeah, mate, yeah, didn't go. But, busy that day. But
you didn't go?
No.
Why didn't you go?
I'm not into it, mate. I'm just not into it. You know, that whole thing just doesn't interest me. It really, not kind of all that keen.
Your manager, who you referred to, John Stanton, said that because you're much bigger in America than in Australia, said he doesn't think that Australians know how to watch you, that some of them feel embarrassed.
Mm.
Do you reckon that's a fair call?
Yeah, I do, I do. Absolutely. I'm very embarrassing to look at. You know why? Here's why I'm embarrassing, because there's a little bit of me in everybody. There really is, you know, and I'm like the boy that never grew up. I'm very, very passionate about what I do. I mean, I love what I do. I am so... And I wake up in the morning on fire, and people are like, God, give this guy a... Valium or something, you know? Can't he have a bad day? And I'm not. And I'm not. And I guess people, especially Australians, you know, they're so, yeah, Steve-o, yeah, whatever, you know. You know, that Australians are like that. They're very, take it or leave it, whatever type thing. Yeah, no, he's too hype, eh? Bloke's on fire, you know. Yeah, so I guess that little bit of me and everybody kind of must be embarrassing, yeah.
I've got to say, passion's a pretty impressive thing.
It is, mate. Yeah.
Steve Irwin, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.